Working Podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin, working on a help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And we're on episode 35. Not much information about 35. It's an odd number. And the other thing is quite odd is Jerry's got a cold, I've got a cough, so we're not all together 100% this week, but we've had a busy week. But so what's everyone been up to?
Yeah, I had an interesting one this week. I had a, yeah, we have a, now that on my new place, we have it where the, where alerts come in when, if an error comes in on the event viewer, and we got a couple of errors in from this error, basically an alert saying, like in the event view, that there was an error, there's an unrecoverable disk media error during the rebuild of a recovery option on physical disk 01 controller 0. And it was a Dell server, it's quite an old server, it's running Windows 2003, which is quite old. This must be quite an old server. It's running a Dell PERT controller. And interesting, it looked like it's fixing the errors absolutely fine, but what had happened is that I was looking in the event viewer because they say it keeps coming up and then going away. And I thought, well, maybe it's a dodgy disk. So I looked in the event viewer, but also in the disk, there was a informational alert in there. So it wasn't giving you the red cross. It was just giving you like a telling about the information. It was saying that there was a sense key free code error. And it was basically saying, sense key, free sense code, 11 sense qualifier, 0 on physical 01. And that didn't really make much sense. So I went in to have a look on Google, and on Wikipedia, there's a what basically tells you what those SCSI keys are. So what they actually mean, and what it is actually saying, that there's a medium error with unrecoverable read errors. So what it was saying is that it couldn't read disks, and there's like loads of these happening every like couple of minutes. So because it's a Dell box, you can, there's a thing in there called which is open managed, which you can go into and you can basically look at what the RAID is. And it's basically, it was two like 160 gig SATA disks in a RAID 1, so that's in a mirror. So basically it was just mirroring the disk. So if something gets whipped from one disk, it gets written to the other disk. And it looked like the second disk was failing, but there wasn't many logs on the server to actually go through on this Dell open managed, because it's like server was over 3 years old. There's no warranty from Dell, so I mean we could have probably waited for this disk to if it's going to fail or whatever. But what you can do is you can do a consistency check on the disk in the Dell Open Manager. So I wanted to just make sure that the disk was okay, so I did that. And then 10 minutes later, alert came in saying that the disk had failed. So that was interesting. And then, so we got a replacement disk in, but it was not a hot swappable. So it was just like, so we would have to arrange downtime for the server. So this server was at a hotel, in a like a country pub, which was also a hotel. So I turn up with this disk to replace it, but obviously you can't get a 160 gig replacement now. So we got a bigger drive, because it doesn't matter if you're mirroring a drive, it really matters. It has to be the same model with the same size or bigger. You can't get one with like smaller. So I turned up, I go to the lady, "Where's your server?" And she goes, "It's up in the loft." I went, "Okay," so she pointed to this hole in the ceiling above the bar, like this door, this door. So, yeah, and she pulled a ladder out for me, the step ladder, and get it up there.
I had one exactly like that one time many years ago. It was in a school, and their server, for some reason, they put it in above. It's kind of in like the school hall, but it's like above the stage or something. God knows why. I mean, it's just there on its own. And I had to, yeah, exactly the same. I had to go up on the stepladder which was okay. The difficult bit was getting down. It's like when you get stuck up a tree and you can't get down. Exactly like that. And I remember the guy saying, you know, just if it goes, just save yourself. Never mind the server.
So I go up inside and I have a look, and I'm looking and go, oh, great. So after remotely, there's no monitor up there. So after RDP into it, shut it down, took ages to shut down, finally shut down, took it apart, put the new disc in, turned it back on. There's no monitor, there's nothing you can do. Waited 20 minutes with the power back up, nothing, no response to the network. So I had to take the monitor off the till, like on the and carry it
back up the stepladder, right?
Yeah, up the stepladder. Plug it all in, and it was moaning that the RAID had still failed and that there was no new disc in there. So I was like, oh, great. I go into the RAID. You can go into, obviously, going like when you boot up in the BIOS, you can then obviously go into the RAID controller. Go into the RAID controller. Yep, it can see the second disc, but you can't add it into the RAID or anything. So, okay. Rebooted it again. Re-plugged everything up again. Rebooted it this time. It says, yep, RAID's failed. Do you want to continue to boot? Yes. No hard disk found. No operating system found. And going, shit. Kind of thing. What am I going to do with this now? And so, all right, then go into the BIOS. I thought maybe the RAID controllers, you know, like in the BIOS, you can tell it like boot from the floppy or the CD-ROM or whatever. I thought maybe sometimes it loses it, that it goes like the CD-ROM drive, or sometimes if you have like it in the old, I can remember the old servers, I think it must have been a Dell, where you could like say, even though it's got a RAID card in it, you have to tell it that that you need to boot not from the SATA but from the RAID controller.
Yeah, but I've seen that before.
RAID controller first. Brilliant. Rebooted it again. Still no game. Oh, I'm going, oh, great. This is great. Yeah. Then I went into the BIOS again. And there's another option I found this time, and it said. And they had the normal like startup option, but in another option, it said hard drive or hard disk order. Went into that USB drive. It said first, then the SCSI card. Looked around the back of the UPS, there was a USB hard drive sitting on the floor.
Okay.
Unplugged the USB hard drive, set the order so that it goes to the RAID controller first. Yeah, straight up this time. So. Yeah, get back into Windows, go into OpenManage. I could see that the new disk was in there. The RAID had failed. It was saying it had one disk in it. But annoyingly, there's no way of adding this disk back into the array. I was going, oh, here we go. Problem after problem here. And then the only way you could do it was by telling that this hard drive that you added in was a hot spare. So was the only option I could do. So I set it to hot spare. And they went, all right, hot spare. Oh, my RAID failed. I'm going to add my disk back into the array. Within an hour, the disk had kind of, it only had like 50 gig worth of data on it. It basically synced itself up, and it was happy jewelry kind of thing. So
I've had a similar thing with OpenManage, because my old job, we use it quite extensively, just for finding out when disks are failing. And it's actually quite good on Linux. You've got quite a few command line tools to do reporting and configuring and things like that. And but I think I remember one where you had to, it was something like you had to make it a RAID 0 array with one disk, because that was the only option for adding a disk and getting it to recognize it. Which is a bit strange, but it works, you know, and it's perfectly valid, but it's just like, within the logic of the RAID controller, that's the only way you can get it to do it. I think that's what it was anyway. RAID 0 with one disk, or RAID 1 with one disk, or something like that.
Yeah, I remember. It's really odd, because in the in Dell, they like have virtual disks, and like they have the physical disk, and they have the virtual disk, which is a bit confusing.
Yeah. So the virtual disk is just the RAID array, basically. What you get when you do whatever. Make the hardware RAID.
Yeah, right? I've got another story later on to tell you about the HP equivalent. Because most of my kit we sell is HP kind of thing, and that's what I like. So we can go on about that. So that's my first story of the night where I've had kind of nearly trained my pants kind of thing on site kind of thing. So that's like the first site I get to visit my new job, like on site kind of thing. So
always pack a spare pair of pants.
Are a lot of them hot swappable then?
Yeah, normally they're hot swappable, so you haven't got to take the server down. Because one was not hot swappable, you had to take the server down, unplug the hard drive and plug it back in again. So,
how would you know if it is hot swappable or not?
It would tell you in the RAID controller kind of thing. And normally as well, you get on the hot swappables, they're like a little cage, so you can, like a little button you can press and it flicks up and you can pull it straight out. Whereas like a non-hot swappable would literally like you to have the hard drive inside your...
Bit harder to take out.
Yeah, so I literally had to...
You have to break out the screwdriver or
Yeah, so I had to basically shut the server down, take the front off, take the side off, unplug the hard drive.
So like a NAS drive would probably be a cold swap.
Yeah.
Would it? Okay.
Depends on, like, the more expensive ones, they tend to have that, you know, the hard drives in caddies, so you can just pull them out. And
now, what's the rules again about... the size of the drive, and the, is it the make and the gigabytes have to be the same or bigger? Is it something like that?
It has to be the logical, the size, the physical. Normally, I'd say you need to have the same make, but you couldn't, you can't get 146 gig drive anymore. But you could probably get one off eBay, but obviously it'd be a second-hand one, so it wouldn't be. Wouldn't be any warranty in it, but we basically, you can go on the Dell website and you can basically find what the equivalent one is now. So we replaced it with like a 600 gig drive or something, but obviously you won't see that in the logical drive, so or in the virtual disk. So basically, if you failed it, you have to get a disk which has got this is bigger than the actual disk. So if it's 146 gigabyte disk, let's say, and you've got one which is a Samsung, and then you've got a Hitachi, whatever they ever make, or a Wedge Digital one at 146 as well. Those 146, they might be 146 gig each, but they, but if you look at right down at the actual disk, they could be separate, different, separate. If you know what I mean, they could be, they could not be exactly the same. So one, they have to be, one drive has to be bigger than the other. So one, whatever the logical drive is, it will, if you see what I mean, if that makes sense.
But you can only see the smaller size.
Yeah.
The original. Now, what happens if, say, if you had the 160 in.
Yeah.
And then you replace that with a hard drive B with a 500.
Yeah.
Right? You'd still only see the 160. But if you then swapped hard drive A to another 500.
Yeah.
Would you still only see the 160 because that's the original RAID, or would you now see the 500?
Right. So we're getting a bit further. So basically, you, what you do is you get your physical disks, okay?
Yeah.
And then when you create a RAID, you create, as I like to call it in HP, it's called a logical disk on top of it.
Yeah.
So you create a logical disk. So your physical disks in your array now will be, your both disks will be 500 gig, let's say. But your logical disk is only 146 gig. If your RAID card supports it, you can expand that array, okay? So you can expand that logical disk to whatever size you want, okay? But your RAID card will have to support that. Because some of the RAID cards, even the basic ones you buy with HP, does not have the facility of expanding a RAID. You have to buy that as an extra option. So once you can do it, but obviously both disks have to be bigger. Because I know people in the past, like when you got, if you're like in a RAID 5 set, you pull a disc out, it's all a bit scary, pull a disc out, put one disc in, it rebuilds the array. You then, when the RAID's built correctly, you make sure it's all happy, you can pull the second drive out. Again, it then rebuilds the array. Pull the third drive, make sure it's all up again, and then you pull the third array out, the disc out of the RAID, and then you've got it. You then got your physical disk all then running at, let's say, that 146 gig, and now at 300 gig drive each. You can then go into your RAID control and you can right click, and if it's an HP box, it'd go into your HP AC, which is your array configuration utility. You can then expand the array. And then once you expand the array, you can go back into Windows and then refresh it in your disk manager, and then you should see that spare space, and then you can then basically expand it in Windows.
So you can do a sort of rolling upgrade if you're clever about it.
You can
keep expanding the disk.
But you have to be very careful, because if you have a disk and it fails, because I know of a customer, not my current job, where it wasn't even a customer, someone helping, saying, can you help us? I said, well, what he had done is he'd basically done what we had said in a RAID 5 array. He'd got some new disks, put one disk in, it was fine. Put the second disk in, it was fine. Went to put the third disk in, pulled the third disk out, put the brand new disk in it to start rebuilding the array. The second disk failed while it was rebuilding the array. Because with RAID 5, you've got three disks, and you've got RAID 5 is where it writes. It
writes parity information to the third disk, or doesn't it write it across all three disks? Or
it writes all across three disks, but it puts two bits of data. It puts two bits of data on put a bit on each disk, but puts one bit on one disk, one bit on the other disk, and the third bit, it does some sort of calculation between the two, doesn't it? And puts on the parent.
Yeah, so that it can always get back to that bit of data from that calculation. Block level stripe. I just googled it. Wikipedia has block level striping with distributed parity. Yeah. So,
but it doesn't.
The parity information is split across the disk.
Yes, if you got a disk in a RAID 5, A, B, and C, and so the first time it writes a bit of data, it puts bit on data. So it puts the same data on A, the same data on B, and then it puts a parity on C. It doesn't on the next bit of data. It doesn't put it on A, B, C. It would put data on B, C, and the parity would then go on to A. Because what happens if you ever lose a disk, which we were saying, you can, the parity is worked out. But I think it does. Does it like B? Some calculation, is it like A times B equals C? What the parity? And if whatever you use any of those bits of information, you can always get that information back. But if you lose more than one disk in the RAID 5 array, then you're stuffed, because, and that's what it done. And it's going, well, is there anything I can do to get that back? And I'm going, no.
Backups.
Yeah. And but that's where RAID 6 comes in, because you can do it so it writes it, the parity gets written to two disks, but then obviously they lose lots of space. But
I think we need to dedicate about 10 episodes to RAID.
Yeah.
It seems to get more complicated the more stripes and RAIDs and parities and... But, well, that's it. I was just wondering if that was the case, because sometimes if you did an image of a Windows drive off a smaller drive and then put it onto a bigger drive, when you boot back into Windows again, it can only see the partitions, and you can only see as a smaller bit,
mm-hmm.
and then you can go into Disk Manager and then expand disk, and then it fills it out then to the whole drive again. I just wondered if it's the same in the RAID one, because as I've mentioned in some previous shows, we've got some NAS drives which are set up as RAIDs. So I'm just kind of preparing, what if one of those hard drives fails in the future? It's a very similar situation to what you had then, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You had two drives in a RAID 1, minor terabytes, 2 terabytes in it.
It depends. I think it really depends on sort of how expensive the NAS box was.
Yeah.
If it's a sort of higher end one, it's more likely to support that kind of thing. If it's just a sort of standard one, like I've got one just by my feet now, but and it wouldn't do that kind of thing. It's literally, if a drive fails, just replace it, and that's about it, really.
Yeah. So if that so that one's it's like it's a TrendNet or a TP-Link one, I think it is that they've got. So
it's probably that sounds like more consumer level. So
yeah, pretty much.
Looking at, I think you'd just be looking at get some spare discs, and when one fails, as it will, eventually, just be prepared to go in there and replace it.
So we just power it down, put the new one in, power it back up, and walk away.
And there'll probably be something in the interface to tell it to re-sync itself.
Is that the kind of thing?
And then walk away.
Yeah. Is that the kind of thing that you'd leave, depending on how much data they've got, that you'd leave like overnight or something?
My one took, it's 4 terabytes, and it took 8 hours or so, I think.
Yeah.
It's fairly fast. A lot of them are Linux based, and they're using the Linux software RAID software. So
now, in the meantime, say you've got one disk failed, the system still runs, doesn't it? But is there a slight loss of performance for the meantime?
I don't think you'll notice any loss in performance. If anything, you haven't got the penalty of writing to two disks when there's a write.
Yeah.
If it's RAID 1, you have to write to two disks at the same time.
Yeah.
So if anything, it could be a little bit faster with RAID 1.
Now, some of these I haven't got monitoring software on, so how would you know?
How it's reading and writing.
Yeah, well, how would you know if a disk has failed, or how would the customer know?
Well, luckily, most of these NASs have email alerts on them, so configuring email alerts on them, so make sure email alerts working.
I have not done that, so I will do that.
And also, as well, if it's a good NAS, something like a QNAP or a Synology box or something like that, will have an email built-in function. Although, like, they will do SNMP, which we've talked about in the past, I don't know if you've got any of your customers on retainer, but have it as one of your weekly checks kind of thing, to go in there and check for a failed disk.
I see,
But that'd definitely go in there and check. I mean, most of them do. Even the things like the Buffalo NASs, I think, will have some sort of kind of login, if you know what I mean.
I think I've seen some of them which have had, you boot them up, there's a on the NAS itself, not that anyone will be looking at it, but on the NAS itself will have a power light and a light for drive 1 and a light for drive 2.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if one of them would start flashing profusely at you or something.
Normally they start, some NASs even start beeping, or some of them go to a red light.
Oh, right, yeah.
So,
I mean, some of them, one of them that they have is in the office with them.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they'll know. Well, one of them's up on the shelf, so they'll see something different. One of the other ones is in a completely different storage room that no one hardly ever goes into. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to be honest as well, I mean, none of those ones aren't on retainer or anything like that. But, the history with them is I've been over to see them for this, that, and the other fairly regular, so that's why I'm thinking next time I'm over there, I'll set up the email alerts on them at least.
Yeah.
Every time I'm there, I'll check on it,
If you can have something proactive, then, it looks good for you. And you say, oh, look, a disk failed. And also, you can charge them for replacing it if they're not on retainer.
So. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah.
No, anyway, so that's my first... So what have you been up to, Andy?
What have I been doing? Well, I've got a couple of little things. I mentioned on the show a couple of episodes ago about that funny thing where I was using VirtualBox and it wouldn't load every you load up the virtual image and it'd fail about 4 times and then it would eventually load. Well, you mentioned something. I can think you Googled it while you were on the show, there's two things that are dead, and one of them fixed it anyway. One of them is because I had malware bytes running in the background. I stopped malware bytes. That seemed to fix it as well. That seemed to fix it initially. So go into end task of malware bytes, and then I didn't have that problem anymore. And also as well, eventually I updated VirtualBox to a newer version, and then since I've done both of them, I haven't had that error whatsoever. So I don't know if whether the malware batch was the problem and then one of the updates has fixed a possible issue that lots of people have been having with it. But anyway, that bit's working good again. And another thing as well with VirtualBox I've been having is I've been noticing that my VirtualBox images have been failing to start, you know. So say I've got an image with Ubuntu on or something like that, and it's been working perfectly fine, and then all of a sudden one day I'd go to load up the image and there'd be all sorts of hundreds of Linux errors saying cannot boot to this and all this kind of stuff. I haven't got the errors up on the screen, so I can't tell you what they were, but I think I've got down to the to a cause of it. Because I've been using, within VirtualBox, I've been using dynamic disk space, hoping that it would, you know, allocate more space as and when was required and not have it as fixed. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that when I've been doing this, that, and the other on the image, maybe doing updates or installing programs or whatever, and then I get to the point where it says, Ubuntu message had come up saying, you know, cannot install this, you know, disk is full. And that's because the dynamic drive only had so many gigabytes allocated to it. So then it said disk was full. So I thought, oh, okay. Just hoping that VirtualBox would just add more space to the disk. And then that's when I'd noticed, after I got that error message up, and then eventually shut the image down. Next time I booted the image back up again, it would fail to boot again. So that's one funny thing I've been coming across. I don't really store that much stuff on the virtual boxes, so I've since made a new virtual box drive and made it a fixed disk, but just made the disk like much bigger. I think dynamically it just gave it 8 gigabyte hard drive to begin with, and it was supposed to dynamically change it as and when required it. So I've just made a 20 gig, I made a 20 gig virtual hard disk, if you like, so there's plenty of room on it. And then since then, the images haven't been failing. But I don't know if that's been a common thing that's happened before, or whether other people have had the same problem. But that's certainly something I've come across this week. And another thing as well I've been doing is, see, I haven't got that much this week really, but another thing I've been doing this week is on one of the sites that I work on, where they have CCTV cameras, and they have the cameras, you know, you could port forward the cameras, so the owners like to keep track of what's going on. Mainly for security and that, because the trade in the States has been getting broken into, you see. And there's, so up until now, they've had two different CCTV recorders in two different buildings on the site, and they've both been supplied by two completely separate ISPs. So each hard disk box has been doing a DDNS off to Dyn DNS or whatever, and they've been using. And then each individual router in each on each ISP has been port forwarding individually. One of the problems that they've had is one of the units is now vacated, basically. So the people that were there have gone. And thus the ISP, their internet has gone off because no one's been paying for it, so that's been cancelled. So the CCTV box was located in that building. That building now has no internet. So what the electrician's been doing there is he's put in an Ethernet cable. He reckoned it was about 80 meters or so I thought that should be all right. And he's put an Ethernet cable into the the original or the location of the first router all the way over to the other building. So they said, they did this all by themselves. You see, they said, oh, we'll just plug it in over there and pull a cable in and everything's great. And then they asked me to come and they said, oh, could you do the port forwarding on this CCTV box? Because it's obviously getting plugged into another router now. So off the top of my head, I said, yeah, I said, that's no problem. I can do that. And when I got there, that's when I suddenly realized that both of the boxes use port 80 as the port number, you see. And then I was thinking, hang on a minute, if they're both using port 80, then when I go into, it was only a standard BT business hub router, when I go into the port forwarding and that, you say port 80 forward to IP address 1.100 or whatever it is. And then I thought, well, I can't put another port 80 and forward it to another IP address. So
no, that's the thing with NAT. You can only, each device behind the NAT can only use one port.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, at first I didn't think about that, but when I got there to actually do it, I thought, oh, hang on, that uses port 80. And then I realised, oh, hang on, the second one's been using port 80 as well. And that's, after a bit of thinking about it, that's when I realised, oh, hang on, this one is adjustable. So I turned it into port 8080 and used that instead. So then I could do it, because then I could set up port 8080 could forward to 1.100, I think we used, and then port 80 could forward to 1.101, for example. Yeah. So we did it that way. And then I had to reboot the router, and then it all reconnected again on the specific ports again. So that was something that kind of that flummoxed me for about 5 minutes. And I was just trying to think of a different way of doing it. But I changed one to 8080 and did it that way, and everything seemed to work. So
you don't necessarily have to forward port 80 to port 80. You can, you know, you can forward port 80 to port 1234 or whatever.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah.
It just depends. I mean, if you're going to it in a browser, like the browser always goes to port 80, so whenever you type, you know, google.com, what you're actually going to is google.com colon 80.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can put a colon and then anything up to 65536.
Right, but one of the problems I had is the actual CCTV box, when you went into its own internal setup, then there was only port 80. One of them only had port 80 available, and I couldn't change it on one of the boxes. It was port 80, okay. And that was it. I mean, it was not exactly a very high-end box, so it was stuck on port 80, but luckily the other box had about three options ultimately, but one of the options was 80 and one of the options was 8080. So
what Jerry was saying is that on the router, you could, if the both boxes were both on 80,
yeah,
and both boxes couldn't be changed, on most routers you can say, if anything received on port 8080, forward it to port 80 on this IP address, if you see what I mean.
Oh, you can, right?
Yeah, some routers are really annoying, and you can only have, you know, port 80 go to port 80, or port 60, or port 6000 go to port 6000. But that's a limitation of the router software, not the actual technology.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah. See, but I get it. Yeah, yeah. I didn't notice that, to be honest, but that was my workaround for the problem. But I see exactly what you mean, yeah.
There's a good website called portforwarding.com. I don't know if it still exists. I remember in the old days when I used to... And you can basically put the model of your router in there, and it will say what ports you wanted to forward, and it will like do a screenshot of how to change it to each of the things, how each was of the it, steps.
Was it one of you two, or was it maybe on another podcast I was listening to, where there's a website where you can kind of simulate... you can emulate, I suppose the word is, emulate all these different routers, and you can put your settings in and see how it all works. I don't know if one of you said that or whether that's someone else's podcast I was listening to.
I said something on the other podcast about the guys asking about if he could, what he could do to get into like networking servers and stuff. And I said there's an application called NS3, which you can replicate the Cisco routers and stuff.
Okay, yeah. So. Yeah, they're the main... I mean, I've had a really busy week this week, but most of the stuff has not really been admin compatible material. Because I've been working on a couple of Macs this week. One of them just had the new, just updated to the new 10.11. What was it called? El Capitan, is it, or something?
El Capitan. Yeah.
And we figured out, so it's an old Mac and it only had 2 gig of memory. So it was running quite slow, so we just had to up it to 4. That's another thing I've been doing this week. And there was somebody else who had nothing but Macs. He had Mac iPads, Mac computer, iPhone, and they wanted to synchronize all the calendars up together. So that's relatively straightforward to do on Macs, isn't it? To be just synchronize your calendars all under the same Apple account.
I assume it's done through iCloud or something. I've only got one Mac, so I can't really.
Yeah, so if you have an iCloud account, you know, just a iCloud email address or whatever, and then you just log each device into that particular. It's a bit like having Google Plus, Google Mail, you know, and you sign into Google Mail on your phone, and you've got a calendar. You can sign into Google Mail on your computer, you've got a calendar. And they all sync up, don't they? When you put it in one, it appears on the other. It's exactly the same.
That's something I discovered this week, actually. I've got a personal Gmail account. And my new job, they use Google Apps for Business. So there's like a work Gmail account, basically. Yeah. And normally, with something like that, because of the way cookies work, you can only be logged into one at a time. But with Google, you can be logged in. They do some trickery where you can be logged into both at the same time, which is really handy because I can keep an eye on my personal Gmail and never miss a work email as well. So
that's true. Yeah,
that's pretty good.
Yeah. So they're my interesting things for the week. We're on to Jerry now, aren't we? What have you been doing?
Yeah. Well, I've just been doing more stuff at my new place. I mentioned in the last episode. Basically working with AWS, which is Amazon's infrastructure as a service offering. Just learning a bit more about that and learning about the systems, the way that my new employer uses it, really. I've been looking at... Just a different way of working, really. We kind of came across this in my old job. When you've got a system, you can either there's kind of two choices if you're going to configure it. You can reboot it from scratch using this automated system. Now, where I used to work, it was FAI, fully automated install, which is like a Debian thing. Where you basically code the configuration, and when you hit reboot and it rebuilds, it takes this configuration. When the machine comes up, it's all configured. Now, configuration management software like Ansible, which I've gone on about in the past, or Puppet, does that to kind of the running machine. So in that scenario, you'd probably build a very basic machine, you know, just networking and disk partitioning done and everything, and then you would use Ansible or Puppet to configure it. But the approach they're using at my new place is, if you make a change to something, you rebuild the machine. So it was pretty quick and easy, but it kind of takes that machine out of circulation for the time it takes to rebuild, which could be 5-10 minutes or so. So you have to kind of plan around that. So if you're taking, say, like a web server down, you have to have other machines which can take up that role while that's happening, so that the service is not affected. So I'm thinking once it's my sort of initiation period, if you like, is over, I'm thinking of taking a bit of a hybrid approach. So putting Ansible in to do sort of day-to-day configuration changes if anything needs doing, and the sort of large-scale things done using this rebuild process, basically putting everything in to a kind of configuration when it's rebuilt. That's called cloud config in AWS speak. Well, I think it might be an Ubuntu specific thing, but I'll have to look into that a bit more.
So,
but Sorry, yeah.
So you're basically saying that if you needed to make a change or update something, you have to rebuild the whole machine. Is that what you say?
Yeah. Yeah. Because then it comes up with a known configuration. But whereas I think the approach these days, a lot of the time, is to just use Ansible or Puppet or Chef or one of those things to change the running configuration. But it is a bit of a sort of a dilemma, if you like, in these circles. You know, do you rebuild the machine from scratch or do you change it when it's running? Because if you rebuild it from scratch, you know it's in a certain state and you know that state's not going to change. Whereas if you're running configuration management software, that it could change in uncertain ways. So if you want to know the state of your machine, you rebuild it from scratch and you plan around losing a machine for 5-10 minutes. So yeah, it's quite interesting.
I have to have a think about that. I don't know if I like the idea of that.
Yeah, well, it does. I mean, this is another thing that sort of changed the way of thinking, where a machine kind of does one thing, and it's even things like a database in AWS. You have a particular instance that holds the database, so and another machine where you serve the database from, or which uses the database. Mm-hmm. So you can rebuild the database node and the database itself stays, you know, live. Well, not stays live, but you don't lose the data.
Yeah.
So you can rebuild the server, but you keep the database, kind of thing. So you're decoupling everything and breaking it into functions rather than having a server which is, say, a database server and does a few other things as well. So it's a different way of looking at things, really. It's the same with a lot of the things which I've been learning over the past few weeks. Everything's in kind of small chunks and has certain responsibilities, and you've just got to architect things in such a way that it all works, basically.
Yeah, your build scripts will have to work, if you know what I mean. So
yeah, but you can test that in advance, where you have like a sandbox environment, or what were you doing is, I think what a lot of people would do is use Vagrant, which is, talking about VirtualBox earlier, it uses VirtualBox as a virtualization engine, but the idea is you run it on your computer and you test things out on your computer, mm-hmm. on your desktop or laptop or whatever, test that it all works, and then if it works, go ahead in production or wherever. But yeah, it is a different way of looking at things, and not quite used to it yet, but I'll get there in the end. But I will get a bit of Ansible in there in the meantime, I think.
Are you using any kind of load balancers in there, or is it just all done in AWS?
Well, AWS has load balancers. It's not really even like an instance. It just all it does is load balance. So, and it does things like SSL termination. So, if you do an HTTPS request, it goes into the load balancer and comes out the other end as non-HTTPS. Yeah. But it's all on a kind of private network, so it's a lot easier to deal with. A lot easier to deal with the traffic than,
unless you've got an attacker inside your behind your firewall.
Yeah, but I think the thing with the security groups and so on, I think I read about it though. You can get like rogue EC2, Amazon EC2 instances, which are just kind of trying to do bad things within Amazon's network. So yeah, something to be careful of.
Cool. All right, have you got anything else to report back? Or?
Yeah, well, I've actually got a link to this tool I've been using, because the way this system is being built that my employee's using is using Debian packages for everything. So deploying the software that the whole thing runs on, that's all done by Debian packaged. Changes that I'm making, that's all done by Debian package. I think time's getting on a bit, so we can go into Debian packaging another time if you like. But there's a system which they've developed called Metalis, which has recently been open sourced on GitHub, which uses, it's quite clever, uses is GitHub itself and Docker, which is another bit of software, containers, which maybe we'll cover that in a future podcast. I think that's the way the industry is going, basically.
Yeah, we were talking about that. Like, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's basically like really lightweight virtualization in a way, in a kind of. probably, you know, like you say, we could probably devote another episode to it. Many other podcasts probably already have, but yeah, so it uses that and something else. Jenkins, which is a server software which basically runs jobs, give it a list of things to do, and it does it. And it, if it was successful, it tells you. If it fails, it tells you. That's how that all works. But I'll put the link in the show notes, and if anyone's interested, they can have a look. That's what we're using at work, so it works really well. And the main thing is, it's the Debian packaging. If you go online and just Google it, you get all these old tools which have been around for getting on for 10 years, and this is a kind of a new approach to it, so maybe worth looking at. Yeah. So that's my lot, really. Not much more to report. I'm getting used to my Mac. I'll put that in the show notes as well. Mm-hmm. Still getting used to it. Still hitting the wrong keys, but getting there.
Cool. Okay. Well, we've had some mail, haven't we, Andy?
Oh yes, we have. Yeah. Yeah, I've had a couple of emails since the last show. I've just brought them up now. Okay, I'll go with the first one, see what we say. So the first email says, "Hi guys, I'm Alyssa since your first episode. I love the show and I learn a lot from you. I have migrated my organization to Office 365 a year ago. I've made a cutover migration from 2007 to 365, and I have kept the 2007 for management purposes, as I have found in most articles I've read, including I'm working with DIR Sync. My question is as follows. During this year, I found myself creating the user in AD and then creating its MEU in the Exchange. The only time I found the Exchange useful is when I've added another mail domain and changed all users' reply address. Should I keep the Exchange, or can I uninstall it and rely on AD and Office 365. Thanks and keep up the great job. So there's a question for you. So what do you think he should do?
I think this is a question for Jerry.
Well, I don't even know what MEU stands for. I was going to ask you that, Al.
male-enabled user, basically. Or I think it's EMU, do you say? I think it, or MEU.
MEU.
Yeah, I think it's, if I'm right. So
EMU is EMU. That's a large flightless bird.
We need to ask Rod Hull.
So it's MEU, wasn't it? We said, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So Matt,
I guess that's in AD you have users and some are enabled for email and some aren't. I guess. By the sounds of it.
Yeah. So it's, I need to go away and think about this because I actually forgot about this question when you emailed. But it's really bad. Basically, so what he's done, what this listener has done, so he's migrated to Office 365 using a cutover migration, which is where you sync, you basically point your Office 365 to your internal Exchange server using OWA kind of thing. And what happens is it goes in and pulls all email out of Exchange and puts into Office 365. So it creates all your email accounts and everything, and then puts it into Exchange, into Office 365, and it keeps doing this until everything's in sync. Then you redirect all your MX5 records and everything, so it points to Office 365 when you want to go cred. You do a final sync, and then all your mail and everything is working through Office 365. What happens next is, as what you do is obviously you're not using your Exchange on-prem, and what happens is you can normally stop all the Exchange servers because all your mail is not being routed through your Exchange server. So what the listeners is emailing says, can you uninstall the Exchange internally? He says he's already using DirSync, which is the thing which synchronizes your internal accounts to Office 365, so you can sync like password syncing. He didn't say if he was doing password sync, but all the documentation you read on the Microsoft documentation, it says, I'll read it to you if I've got the pages. It says like, this is migrating. So this is, I put in show notes, and it says, migrating all your mailboxes to Exchange Online with a cutover migration. So it basically just goes all through what I said. And it says completing your post-migration tasks. It says about redirecting your records. It then says decommissioning your on-premise Exchange server. After verifying that all your emails is routing directly to Exchange server online mailboxes, have completed the migration and no longer need to maintain the on-premises email organization. Don't implementing a single sign-on solution. You can uninstall Exchange from your server and remove your on-premise Exchange organization. So that's what I'm saying about where you can do a thing where you're basically when you're not actually authenticating against Exchange Office 365, you're authenticating internally. But it says underneath this, it says, important, if you are implementing a single sign-on solution, we strongly recommend you maintain at least one Exchange server on site. So it's like, it's a bit confidential about what they're saying. So I think, and like I read somewhere else, is I've got more than one of these things, and it says, like everyone says, no, decommissioning is another Exchange. I'll put it in notes. It says, after you've done this, it says decommissioning the Exchange on-premise Exchange server. After you've verified the email is being routed directly to Office 365, mailboxes are no longer needed to maintain your on-premise email organization, or don't plan to implement a single sign-on, you can uninstall Exchange. But it says underscore, it says, no, decommissioning Exchange can have unintended consequences. Before decommissioning your on-premise Exchange organization, we recommend you contact Microsoft support. So I would probably just stop the Exchange services on that Exchange server and see if anything breaks. But before installing Exchange, because the problem is you uninstall Exchange, it could take some attributes out of AD, which could break something else. So I'm actually speaking with an Office 365 expert next week, a guy from Microsoft, so I'll ask him what he recommends, and then I'll report back on that. So
okay, great, we'll come back on to it next episode, hopefully. We'll just have to make a note to remind ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, we'll move on to the next email then, a bit more of a longer one this. I don't know who that last email was from, actually.
Oh, I'll have a look while you're...
I never mentioned it.
I can't look at it, see.
Okay, right, so next email says, hello, thank you very much for your excellent podcast. A few shows ago, I think that Al said something about wanting to improve his writing style.
I'll just cut in there.
Yep.
That was Israel Silberg. I've just let that
out. Oh, that's right, yeah. I remember that.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks for the mail, Israel.
Yeah, it was
Cheers.
A good one.
Keep them coming.
Sorry,
carry on, Andy.
Yeah, we'll carry on. Right, so he says, I have not knowingly read any of his writing, and I'm not sure what the issue is precisely, and I have no expertise in this area. I think that he, like Andy and Jerry too, speaks clearly and coherently, and he is clearly knowledgeable and enthusiastic, and so gives his audience a very enjoyable listening experience. My tip for anyone wishing to improve their writing for what they are worth are... Right, number one, try to regularly read examples of the types of writing you admire and enjoy reading. Number two, use spell checking software and perhaps also grammar checking software, though they can sometimes be too pedantic, especially if, like me, you're brought up during a time when grammar was hardly taught at school. And so you should, like me, know little more than what verbs, nouns, adjectives, adverbs are, and so cannot really understand the error messages in the grammar checker. Number three, read a guide to clear writing style. Try to avoid anything that sounds too pedantic unless you enjoy that. Number four, avoid trying to be too clever and instead just write what you would speak to your audience. Some people try to write using business jargon in an attempt to sound good, but it can often just hinder effective communication. Number five, consider using speech-to-text dictation software if you find that the process of typing is causing the issue. Number six, read back aloud what you have written to see whether it sounds all right. It is often useful to use speech-to-text software to help with this, because it is very easy to just read what we think we have written rather than what we have actually written. For example, in Microsoft Windows, you could try Microsoft Narrator. Since it's built in, or download a more fully featured screen reader such as NVDA, which is free and open source software. On an Apple product, you can use VoiceOver, which is built in. And in Geo and Linux, you can use Orca or SpeakUp. If you do not like the default voice, try others. Number seven, if you have friends whose writing style you admire and enjoy, you can ask them for his or her feedback on your writing. I hope this all helps, and thanks again for a great podcast. And again, I haven't got who that came from, although it's on the original email, so...
That's from David Apps. That's
all right, there you go. Excellent. Yeah, so that was a great email, very detailed. That was particularly at you, because you brought that up a few episodes ago, didn't you, Al? So what do you think of all that?
Yeah, it's quite good. I was getting worried that we weren't getting listeners in or emailing back, so that's quite nice to actually... I write that email when it came in, so that's quite good. Yeah, so a couple of things going through that, which I'm going to try. I do have a problem where I miss things like S's off the end of words and stuff, or which is just me not as hanged, not being taught the right thing. So, and luckily with my new job, I've got people who like reading my, who really like reading it and doing my checking. But I'm definitely going to check out, because that's the problem I have, is I've obviously got it in my head what I want it to sound like, and I read it back, and then you think your mind just reads it back how you want to hear it. Yeah. So I'm gonna basically gonna try one. Yeah, I'm gonna try one of these text to speech thing on my next document, and I'll see. So yeah, it's really good. Yeah, see, I got a really good article. Thanks for emailing it. Really appreciate that. Really.
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, I've had exactly the same thing. You know, you write something, you read it back yourself, and it sounds absolutely fine. And then when someone else reads it to you, it just sounds pathetic. You know. I've had exactly that. Or people say, what does this mean? You know, and to you it sounds great, but to everyone else it doesn't. Yeah, that's one thing. That's one thing I've had in the past as well. But also, what about these text-to-speech software and things like that? You know, I don't know if they're worth trying sometimes. I've never done that, to be honest, so I thought that was a good idea.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to try next, is play it back, and then you can see what it sounds like. I don't know how good it will be or whatever, but we'll... I'll try.
It'd be great. It'd be like Stephen Hawking reading your article back to you. It'd be great.
Yeah, it mentions Orca there, which is basically a screen reader. So
yeah,
you know, she's for sort of blind or partially sighted people to basically read web pages and things. And it's fair. A little aside here: the sort of Windows software, which I think was like the main. For like one of the first ones was called Jaws.
Yes, I've used Linux, Jaws.
So the Linux open source one is called Orca, which is obviously like a killer whale, isn't it? It's like the yeah. Maybe the like the friendly equivalent of, of Jaws. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. If you want to email us in, you can always send an email. I always appreciate emails coming. Even if it get, I like the email popping up, saying, oh, this is emailed in, it's quite good. So, yeah, emails at mail@adminadminpodcast.co.uk. Yeah.
Don't forget, you can always reach us on social media as well, Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus as well, I believe.
Yeah, it's good. So, yeah, I think we nearly are up to date with our podcast. This is episode 35. 34 is just about to be released when we're actually recording this. Yeah. So I think we've had about 3 weeks between this, but now hopefully we've kind of all got back into the sync of it. We can kind of get them released every 2 weeks again. But I'm really annoyed because my current job I'm working at is that I only get half an hour commute every day, so I only get an hour, and there's not really time at work to listen to podcasts at work. So I'm really behind on my podcast. I'm like 30 hours behind.
Whereas I'm commuting up to London now, so I get about 2 hours every day to listen to podcasts now. So I even had time to edit some of the last podcasts on my last commute, so that was good.
Brilliant.
Cool. Okay, guys, we'll keep it to an hour, and we'll speak to you all soon.
That's it, next time.
Cheers. Bye.